Well, thank you for coming. It's a subject that I've been dying to talk about. I told my wife that, and she said that that's just a dad joke. So it is, it is. It's a bad one. So, well, today we're looking at capital punishment. The subject that I've been working on for my dissertation down at Southern is not capital punishment, but it's just the theology of civil government. So in about a year, year and a half from now, I plan on teaching a whole Sunday school class on a theology of civil government. But lately, as I've been writing, this whole thing is aligned very well because Gary asked me to teach on capital punishment, and I've been studying Genesis 1 through 9 in the Hebrew, looking at all these commentaries on that and just kind of understanding the flow of thought in the first few chapters of Genesis. So kind of on the side, just taking notes on related to, it's really loud. Cliff Fleck. Just want everyone to know that. So taking notes on capital punishment. And there it is. That is a picture. I mean, we often put this at a very high thing, but Lady Justice, pretty much every courtroom in the United States has a statue of her or has a painting of her. Our courthouse here in, our two courthouses here in Springfield have that as well. On the Supreme Court, it has that like a painting, and in the back, as the justices look towards the back, sort of as I'm looking at you, you're looking forward, they'd be looking back because they're judging a case, just this sign in Latin, audi alteram partem. Anyone know what that means? Audi alteram partem. I had to ask, I don't know Latin. But just hear the other side is what it says. But what the statue symbolizes is important. It just gives us an ideal, and I think there's a lot of good things there. But it's just she has the sword, kind of giving, showing that she has the authority to take life or to decide those kinds of cases, has the scales of justice sort of to weigh cases. So as cases are brought before her, that whether someone is innocent, whether they're guilty, can weigh that. And you notice on her, what's around her eyes? Anybody see that? It's a real small picture, but a blindfold. Isn't able to see. It's supposed to be a blindfold symbolizing impartiality, that she can't see who is in front of her. So I think that that represents some very good ideals that our legal system ought to be pursuing. But it does raise some important questions in terms of just the greater the more severe the crime, the more important I think these questions become. First, and I'm guessing you can't see these, can you? Not too well, or those in the front I think are saying they can, but it raises some important questions. Just first, who determines what is just? Who determines what is just? I can't even see it, so. But what punishment is appropriate for murder? Historically, it's been capital punishment's been appropriate for murder, and biblically, it's what I'm going to look at today, how that is the just punishment for murder. But in our society, if it's not murder, if it's not capital punishment, which is kind of diminishing, what's the appropriate punishment? And just for as a side note, it was Governor Bill Richardson of New Mexico. I think it was in 2011, New Mexico outlawed capital punishment. And one of his statements, it was kind of a horrifying statement, saying that I got rid of it because, I'm just paraphrasing, I got rid of it because I believe a worse punishment is a living death, putting somebody in giving them a life sentence, putting them in prison because their cell becomes their tomb. Just a horrifying, cruel kind of idea. God has said, no, that is not a just punishment. Justice demands a capital punishment. So, what is appropriate if you're going to say that capital punishment isn't appropriate? And if it is the death penalty, well, how swift should this punishment follow? And I think for those of us, including myself, that support capital punishment, how swift do you execute that punishment? Do you say, well we're going to review the evidence for 3 months, we're going to review it for 6 months, we're going to review it for 25 years? what's appropriate for that? A lot of these questions I'm not going to totally answer in our time today, but they're things to be thinking about. Or when the jury has heard for a civil suit, heard sufficient evidence to decide in favor of the death penalty, when have they heard sufficient evidence? I mean, how long do you keep this thing open before making that decision? So those are things that I think we need to weigh through. Anything else that comes to your mind, just you're thinking about capital punishment, things that you need to consider. in a crowd this size, I'm sure there's not, I would guess not everyone's on the same page. For instance, Chris Wilson.
Well, maybe
the way in which it's done. How so? Okay. A public hanging. Maybe that's not the best way to do it. Yeah, Scott.
The big issue that we have in our time is, are you executing an innocent man?
Are we certain this man is guilty? That's always a question. Sure. Doug.
That was the same thing, clarity of the evidence in the case.
Yeah, and then how certain do you have to be in order to get to that point? So we all know that no system is going to be perfect, but that's why we have to ask these kinds of questions. Capital punishment, just the legally authorized taking of a person's life for a crime. Those are all important parts. I think those are all biblical. Legally authorized, not a vigilante just going around like Batman killing people. legally authorized. Points in history, just as we kind of look back on why is it there's been such a shift against the death penalty in recent centuries, but especially in recent years. You look back in the past, and the ancient Babylonians and the Assyrians, well, the family decided the method of execution. The offended family decided how that person was going to die, which probably wasn't the most humane way to do this. Most of, I spent a lot of time just looking through just history, because I was very curious as I was preparing for this, how did different societies handle capital punishment? And really, there's nothing that I can share with you that'd be appropriate. It's just, this is all I'm willing to share. Romans, beheading or crucifixion. Crucifixion is pretty heinous, but we're all familiar with that. Beheading if you were a citizen of Rome, or a Roman citizen, crucifixion if you were not. The Visigoths, Vikings, medieval warlords, just a whole variety of methods of execution. And for most of these societies, with the exception of the Greeks, you just get the impression that people sat around just being as creative as they could for how we can kill someone and prolong it as much as possible. It's just very, very grotesque. So England, under King Henry VIII, the death penalty, 72,000 people received the death penalty in his 36 years. So 2,000 people a year were sentenced to death. It was basically, I mean, if you say that our system was too slow, or is too slow, his was way too fast. It's pretty much charged, guilty, gone. It's sort of how it went. There wasn't much time for an appeal to be made. So the British Empire in the 18th century expanded capital offenses to 160 crimes. It wasn't just, now many of those revolved around murder, but it went beyond that. You had children that were sentenced to death for different crimes, like 10 and 11-year-olds I read about. Another crime was shoplifting. There were people who were sentenced to death for shoplifting. It kind of gives you the idea of like Jean Valjean in Les Mis, sentenced to 18 years in prison for taking a loaf of bread, only executed for taking that loaf of bread. So it was pretty severe the way these things were handled. Just a couple problems, and some of these you've mentioned so far, is that innocent people did die. If you have 72,000 people dying in 36 years, you're not really concerned whether they're innocent or guilty. You think they're guilty, that's good enough. Another, punishments often didn't fit the crime, shoplifting leading to death, or just other kinds of punishments that were used. And the executions, normally they were very inhumane. And it's just there's just this thread all throughout history, with very few exceptions, very inhumane executions. I think that's something we ought to be concerned about, and we'll talk about that in a second, why. But most of the executions that were done were these public events. It was almost like sport. That you read about that, like the French Revolution, queen being sentenced to death and everybody coming out to the gallows just to watch, or the beheading, just to watch this happen. You know, and she says, let them eat cake. But anyway, so you have just this public spectacle. Everybody loved to kind of see this sort of thing. So all of this is not, so when you say that you support capital, when I say that I support capital punishment, this isn't what we're talking about here. In American history, the United States has 41 federal capital offenses. Now, most of those are related to murder in some way. For instance, First-degree murder, genocide, murder for hire, assassination, killing of a federal prison guard. Those are capital offenses. If the punishment goes through, you would receive the death penalty for those kinds of things. The only exceptions are espionage and treason, which not necessarily murder involved, but anyway, 39 of the 41 are related to murder in some way. Gradual move towards the abolition of the death penalty. And can anyone guess how many people have been sentenced to death in the United States since the founding of our country? Take a guess at it. How many? 300. It's much higher than that. Scott's pretty close. Scott said 5,000. The answer is actually 6,000. 6,000 people, roughly 6,000 have been sentenced to death in the history of our country. And of that 6,000, almost all of them have been sentenced to death prior to 1972. So there's been a shift away from the death penalty, and you can see why. Some of the things I was sharing about history, why there's been such a reaction against it because of all of the abuses with it. But since 1972, it's really, really picked up steam. Benjamin Franklin, this is really in the 18th century is where opposition started growing, but he says it's better for 100 guilty persons, it is better 100 guilty persons should escape than one innocent person should suffer. That might be the motto of, when I was listening to the arguments for and against capital punishment in our capital, in Springfield, just where they were arguing, under Pat Quinn, we abolished the death penalty. That quote's pretty much the reason why it got abolished. Because, I mean, if you could sum up all the arguments against the death penalty, that really was what it came down to. Innocent people were proven to have died. And how do you know they were innocent? Well, with the advent of DNA testing and things like that, it was proven that, well, yeah, these people were innocent. And there's nothing you can do. Dead is dead. So that's a pretty powerful argument, and that's why it really went the way that it did. Before we get into scripture, anything so far? Any questions? Any thoughts on this so far? My guess is that we're in a room this size. Not everybody's saying that they're in favor of capital punishment. There's probably some variations with where we're all at. But any questions so far? Mike.
There are some instances where there are lots of witnesses and someone killing them. Like in a prison situation,
Well, you're talking about one isolated instance where it's just completely clear cut. I mean, when you're dealing with thousands of instances, it is, I mean, it's a given in a fallen world where nothing is perfect. We are going to execute innocent people. It's just how often is that going to happen? Yeah.
Like, for example, gangs, you know, a lot of gang people, there's lots of people like them.
Sure, it's way beyond a reasonable doubt they're guilty. Absolutely. That's, sure. Sure.
I understand why government does this, but it's a ridiculous argument.
I think so. Well, towards the end of our time, I'll show you a little bit why, what makes it so ridiculous, but there was one other hand I think I saw. Yeah. Yeah, actually that was our Attorney General, Lisa Madigan, that was her argument why we should support the death penalty. She was actually for it, saying that, we have more precautions in place than we've ever had in the history of mankind, and yet we're getting rid of it. So, Scott, we'll move on.
The whole aspect of capital punishment being in prison,
Is capital punishment a deterrent to crime? Is that what you were asking? Yeah, we'll get to that. My answer is it should be. Is it? Depends what studies you're reading. But it should be, biblically. So, Jeff, one more thing. There could be. There could be. Yeah. I mean, if it's 99.9% correct, that's still not perfection, even then. So. Well, sure, that's right. Right. Well, biblically, start with Genesis 1, 26 and 27. I think this is a good place to start because the whole, we're going towards Genesis 9, but I kind of want to walk up to provide you some of the context there. But Genesis 1, 26, it says, "Then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image, and the image of God he created him, male and female he created them." Two key words that we need to look at are image and likeness. God created man in his image and likeness. So image, the word, as best as I can tell, it refers to, and there's so much work, it's many papers have been written on these two words, but image basically is a statue, a painting, a representation of some kind of another. So the idea that it conveys is just that statues were set up around different dominions, by a king. King is a statue that sort of has the likeness, looks like, resembles that king, would set up these statues all around his dominion. So right when you walk into his dominion, you see that statue, you know you're under his law, his authority, this is his land. And so that's really the idea that's conveyed by that. Man being in the image of God, God placing man on earth, saying, this is my planet, this is my creation, and you are to govern it, rule it in a way that's pleasing to me. Likeness reduces this, and I've changed a little bit in what I used to think about this word the more that I keep reading on it. It's basically just reducing our status. Jesus is not like God. He is God. He is the image of God. He is like God. We are the image of God, but we are not gods and goddesses. Jesus is not merely like God. We are merely like God. It reduces our status is what it's saying. Image is enough to convey what we are. Likeness reduces that so it's not confused. It's not as if we are other gods and goddesses are going around on the planet. Jesus is God. We are merely like God. It's just making that sort of distinction very, very clear is what a number of the commentators kind of have landed on. So, and I think that's helpful and probably accurate too. So image and likeness is what, I'm pushing the wrong button here. Man is uniquely to be God's ambassador, God's viceroy, God's representative on the earth. So it gives a high status to what we are. We're sinners. The image of God is very marred. We'll see in the rest of Scripture, it still exists. It's not been eradicated or destroyed by sin, though it is marred. But the fact that we are the image of God indicates humanity has a certain dignity that goes with it. So there's a lot of implications upon that, but capital punishment is where we're headed today with this. Genesis 3 and 4, we have the fall. You have glimpses after the fall. What happened when you get to Genesis 4? What is the most predominant or the predominant sin that you see after the fall and before the flood? What was the world described as? Anybody want to take a stab at it? Violence. Violence. The world is characterized by violence. And I only have a couple instances in Genesis 4, but we'll see in Genesis 6 it a little bit more clear. Violence and murder. Cain is jealous. He kills Abel. Cain's grandson Lamech is provoked and kills. Lamech even exults, sings a song about the murder that he's committed. And so you have just the decadence, just this downward spiral of humanity, even in Genesis 4, that the writer's really showing us. Genesis 5, we're going to skip over. Genesis 6, you get to verses 11 through 13. You could turn to Genesis 6. It says, "Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. And God saw the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, I have determined to make an end of all flesh. For behold, the earth is filled with violence through them. Behold, I will destroy them with the earth." And then he says, "Make yourself an ark." And so he's going on and saying, I'm going to save the ark just through this limited family. Eight people in all are going to be saved. All the rest, absolutely destroyed. But the characteristic that, or what characterized the earth is violence. People going around just murdering one another for whatever reason they wanted to do that. The world had become corrupt. When I underline that corrupt, was corrupt, had corrupted, the idea is that the world had been destroying itself. The tense that's used there is just not so much that God steps in to destroy a world that had already been destroying itself. Under the weight of all of the violence and murder and corruption, the world was just splitting apart at the seams, and God steps in, he's had enough. And so a very, very emphatic, really, really intense verse. And then it says just violence, was filled with violence. The world was saturated with violence. I mean, the picture that you could have in mind is like a sponge absorbing water. The world had become so saturated, so filled with violence, God ends it right there. So it gives you, it's easy to read over some of these passages and you're just kind of reading them, but you don't really get a, when you really pause, you get a sense for just how weighty some of these verses really are. Get to the image of God and violence, just putting these together. It gives us a little bit more insight into how sin is so offensive to God. Because when you think about man being the image of God, sin is essentially would be God seeing an image of himself doing things that God himself would never do. It'd be like looking in the mirror. You know, you look in the mirror, you see yourself, you don't expect yourself to do anything crazy because it's a reflection of you. We're not a perfect reflection of God by any means, but we are a reflection to a degree. Sin is God seeing the image of himself doing things that are just so heinous in his sight. Think about that. That applies far beyond the sin of murder, but just any sin that you commit, God seeing an image of himself doing things he would never do. It gives me pause, at least. It makes me think a little bit more about just how sinful sin is in God's sight. When we murder, God sees an image of himself so filled with hatred and rage as to kill another image of himself. Just kind of think about that, just as you're going home today. Think about just that concept of how sin offends God, how murder so offends God. And it would seem, though we place all these distinctions on different kinds of murder, and we have a system that has some crimes are greater than others, God's really, from what I can tell from Genesis, he really places a premium on the sin of murder. In our society, you can kill someone and be out of prison, you know, potentially before too long. My mom lost a friend years ago I remember I was 15 years old, and she got a call right before we were about to go to school one day, and it was one of her best friends saying that her husband was killed by a drunk driver last night. Never have forgotten that phone call. You know, it's just one of those things that you just never forget. And the guy was out in 7 years. That's murder is what that is. You could say, well, it was accidental. He didn't mean to do it. It was murder. And he was out in 7 years. But there are other crimes you can commit. You'll be in prison for 30 or 40 years that aren't murder. I mean, our system is not terrible, but there are some things that are very much not in line with what God, it doesn't hate certain sins the way God hates them. I guess you could say that. Any thoughts on this so far? I'll kind of pause before we go on. Yeah, David.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pervasive. Yeah.
So capital punishment ideally would be a perfect, just, righteous system that's digging out the penalties and investigating crime. But it's not. And I think, you go around.
And you're right. It's not.
I don't know.
There's a. I go beyond saying that right now we're discussing the principle, because you have to have a place, to a foundation to build upon. But I would go beyond saying that. I support it in principle only. You know, I do support that our society at least does it sometimes. I think it's tragic, all of the abuses. I think it's tragic that we've moved away from it because of all of the corruption involved in some of those cases. But I would say I support it beyond just in principle. But anyway, we'll continue. I think we will. Genesis 6, it tells us the world had become so filled with violence and murder to the point that God would look at it no longer. So if you could move to Genesis 9, now we're getting into a little more directly into really the crux of the issue. There's a few texts in Scripture that talk about capital punishment. We won't look at all of them today. We're mainly just looking at Genesis 9. I'll read that. It says, every moving thing, so God speaking to Noah, speaking to every living human being by saying this, every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything, but you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is its blood. And for your lifeblood I will require a reckoning. From every beast I will require it from man, and from man. From his fellow man I will require a reckoning from the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man shall his blood be shed, for God made man in his own image. So two ordinances that are given here. The first one we don't really spend too much time looking at, but we'll do that just here briefly. Two ordinances, but you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is its blood. And then the second one, and for your lifeblood I will require a reckoning. The English doesn't bring that out too well. It just starts with but you and for. I mean, just these conjunctions. But in the Hebrew, it's really clear that these are parallel ordinances. Literally, don't do this and don't do this. So two ordinances are given when Adam steps out of the ark. Man is, on the surface, man is not to eat a live animal. Now you ask, I mean, who would do that? Who would eat a live animal? And the picture that kind of comes to mind, I was sharing this with Gary, is sort of Gollum in Lord of the Rings eating a fish. You know, kill it first. But eating a live animal. But the idea, I mean, you don't need to tear the animal to shreds while it's still moving and in agony. So this command, this first ordinance, when you think about how violent the world had become, that God has to say, don't do this, again, gives you an insight just to the depravity of the human heart. Why would anyone do that? The only reason that you would rip an animal to shreds while it's still alive is just purely for just a sick enjoyment of torturing an animal. There's no reason you need to do that. And so the best that I can tell, there's only two commentators I know that I saw that really get into this, but it's a command against bloodlust, a command against animal cruelty. So I wouldn't use this as to support PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I wouldn't do that, but I would say if you're looking for a command against animal cruelty, Genesis 9:3 is pretty explicit what you're not to do to them. But why is that? The world becomes so filled with violence, but Gerhard von Rad, he says, even when a man slaughters and kills, he is to know he's touching something which, because it is life, is in a very special manner God's property. Animals are not the image of God. We are not on equal foot, or animals are not on equal footing with us. Nothing like that. However, they do have the gift of life that God had given them. There's a certain dignity that ought to be afforded only as a result of that. But then the question really becomes, but how much more important is this for man, who is the image of God? So much greater. Genesis verses 5 and 6, I will require a reckoning from every beast. I will require of it from man. From his fellow man I will require it. That final part, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for God made man in his own image. Really, there's two reasons that I can see just going through Genesis 1 through 9 up to this text. Two reasons for capital punishment biblically. First is practical. This violent world that kept getting worse and worse and worse, and God gives capital punishment as a deterrent that that would not be repeated again. So capital punishment, as I think Scott asked, is it, you know, should it be a deterrent? Should it? I don't know that it has or hasn't been in our country. I'm not sure how to measure that, and there's so many studies that go one way or another. So I can't really even go there. But I would say biblically, it should be a deterrent. It should be done in such a way. And again, I'm not saying what I mean by that, but it should be done in such a way. We'll leave it ambiguous. In such a way that it discourages people from murdering one another. They think twice, because if I do this, justice is going to be enacted and I lose my life. So it ought to deter people from killing one another. The theological reason, even more important, God is personally offended. And saying that capital punishment, a life for a life, it foreshadows, you know, that eye for eye, tooth for tooth, but it really foreshadows that. A punishment that's in keeping with the crime. The crime is so heinous, the only punishment that is just is when you've killed, you lose your life. So I think in principle, that's where what Scripture teaches to this point. But any questions so far, or any thoughts on this so far? Well, we will continue, I think. John Davis wrote a book on, evangelical ethics. But in there he says, when violence in the form of murder is done to a man, it is in effect an outrage against God. Some principles to glean from this. As I had said earlier, the authorities of a people are implied in Genesis 9. Don't have time really to develop how civil government comes from this or anything like that, but or how it's legitimized from this, but it's saying that by man his blood shall be shed, meaning that it's not saying by the family members taking vengeance. It's nothing like that. And I think even the Old Testament law gives a little bit of insight on what you should or shouldn't do with this, but the idea is that there should be leaders of the people that are to carry this out. And that way, people who are ideally are outside of the situation that can step in, judge whether this happened or not, execute the punishment. The authorities also, another principle is the authorities have a duty to execute murderers. God says, I will require a reckoning. It's not an open door, this would be a good idea. Or, you know, this is how I think you ought to deal with, how you ought to govern society. I will require a reckoning. Now, in the case of Cain, when Cain killed his brother, who dealt with Cain in that case? God. God personally even intervened and dealt with Cain. But you don't see that with Lamech, and you don't see that, it seems you don't really see that down the road. God steps in here and is saying civil government now has the authority to deal with this. So there is a certain legitimacy to government restraining sin. Scott. Yeah, there. Right. I had to think about it for a second. But again, it's not as if someone has committed murder and then the family members just get involved and take the guy's life, and you have government getting involved and saying we're protecting this man potentially until. Any other thoughts on this? accidental deaths, though, which, I mean, you can imagine, even if it was accidental, family getting involved and really wanting to go after the person. Jeff, did you? Sure. I mean, we're not, we remember we're not under the Old Testament law, of course, but there's still principles you can glean from it that give us a little bit of insight even into a subject like this. Another principle, process should be a deterrent. As I had said, the ordinance was given to prevent the world from being filled again with violence. We kind of talked about that. And the execution should be dignified and humane because man is the image of God. This would apply, you know, you could think about that with capital punishment, how it ought to be carried out. You know, is in 1972 when the U.S. Supreme Court intervened and put a moratorium on executions until, I think it was 1977, and during that time, that was really the question, are we doing this in a humane way? Now, you might agree or disagree with the Supreme Court's decision, I don't know, but it's a good question to ask. Because man is, and they weren't asking it because man is the image of God, of course, but we should. Man is the image of God. Is this being done in a way that's not torturous? I think that would also apply. This is a tangent from there too, but we're talking about the use of torture. Generally, I'm pretty liberal on that subject. I don't agree with the use of torture, and it's because when I read this, man being the image of God has a certain dignity. You don't go around just torturing people to extract information. It seems, to me at least, it seems very much against these principles. And that doesn't mean I'm a liberal. So, Cliff, I saw you perk up when I said that. Chuck Colson, founder of Prison Fellowship, you know, he was an aide to President Nixon back in the 70s, and when Nixon, the whole Watergate scandal came out, Colson, Ehrlichman, and two other guys spent some time in prison taking the fall for the president. So I think Colson ended up spending 10 months in prison, and it was during that time that, if you read his autobiography, he says that's when he became a Christian. And I don't agree with, there's a number of things about Chuck Colson that are a little bit kind of funny to me, but when it comes to, you know, the amount of time that he's spent ministering to prisoners, I think he kind of weighs in on a topic like this with capital punishment. He says, and I know there's not a chance you can read that, but he says, for as long as I can remember, I have opposed capital punishment. As a lawyer, I observed how flawed the legal system is, and I concluded, as Justice Learned Hand once remarked, as a justice in the 1950s, says, it's better that 100 guilty men go free than one innocent man be executed. I was also influenced by very libertarian views of government. I distrusted government too much to give power to the judicial system to take a human life. And then when I became a Christian, I was confronted with the reality of Jesus' payment of the debt of human sin. I mean, right there you have God sentencing, the foreordination of God the Father sentencing an innocent man to death. And so Colson says, I was confronted with that, and so that was the beginning of starting to rethink some of this. It doesn't mean that, that was the beginning of him starting to rethink some of this. But he says, I still have grave reservations about the way in which capital punishment is administered in the United States. And some of you I know do as well. I do as well. He says, I still do question whether it's a deterrent. But my views have changed. I now favor capital punishment when no other punishment can satisfy the demands of justice. And if we're looking at Scripture, the demands of justice are exactly what we've been talking about today. So he kind of, when he became a believer, started studying Scripture, confronted with the reality of Jesus, an innocent man, being sentenced, his views on this whole subject started to change. Significant New Testament passage. We're kind of towards the end of our time here, but we're not going to look at Romans 13, 1 through 7. If you're taking notes, very important passage. If you're saying, well, this is just in the Old Testament, well, Romans 13, New Testament text, that affirms civil government has the authority from God to punish evil and also affirms capital punishment. Two questions, just to think through, though. If you're, as I was kind of reflecting on a lot of these passages, that if you're against capital punishment or saying, well, I'm only for it in principle, I think about just some of these things. For one, did God know innocent men would die when he sanctioned the death penalty? You know, he's speaking to Noah, sanctioning the death penalty. Did he know that government in a fallen world was not going to be able to execute it in a perfect manner? I think so. A second question, and these are just questions that I was kind of wrestling with, but does God believe it's better for 100 murderers to go free than for one innocent man to be executed? I don't think we can say that God would rather 100 guilty men not receive punishment than one innocent man receive something that he shouldn't. Very serious when an innocent man receives the death penalty. I don't want to dismiss that, make light of that at all. But three concluding thoughts. Sin is infinitely offensive to God. When you think about how heinous sin is, one sin, eternity in hell. One sin. It could be a little white lie, and that's everything. If it's conceivable that you were completely sinless, totally righteous, you told one white lie, just an infinite punishment, eternity in hell, because God is holy. When you think of it that way, if murder is the destruction of God's own image, how offended must he be by that particular sin? I mean, if even a little white lie merits this, how much greater is the offense when you're taking the life of one who has a resemblance to God? I think, and this is where I've concluded, is that God is so offended, he wants the guilty pursued to death, though an innocent may die at times. And that's really where I've landed when it comes to capital punishment, that it is such an offensive thing to God, or that murder is such an offensive thing to God, that yeah, an innocent person might die at times. We don't want that to be often at all. But that sin of murder is so offensive to God, that's why he instituted it. So any final thoughts on this? Gary. I know. I thought we'd be in a different room. It's a little larger. you may need to add to this, but I was just going to say we're not under... That was given to the nation of Israel. That was their civil, ceremonial, moral code of law given to them. That's not given to us. So we can glean principles from it because it's the same God. God gave that. It's still the same God. God is unchanging. We can glean certain principles from that. But we don't want to say that we are... It's called being a theonomist, that the law of Israel is at least to some degree in effect today. We definitely don't think that or teach that here. It is not in effect. It was given to Israel, not to us. So even though there's all these different punishments, I think there's things, and I don't know what off the top of my head, but there are things we can learn from that tell us about the character of God. But we need to be careful drawing from that just a one-to-one correlation, saying, well, they did in Israel, that's what we need to do today. Do you want to add to that, Gary? Is that... Well, Genesis 9, for instance, is given before the law was given to Moses. And so you have all of humanity, all eight, outside the ark, God speaking to Noah, saying, giving these two ordinances. And so it precedes Israel, precedes Abraham even. So that's why Genesis 9 still matters for us today. Is that kind of what you're... Okay. Jenna. Yeah, it goes all the way back to Aristotle, that if we just give it, that education is the solution, the tonic that'll just save society. Education's important, but we know as Christians the heart is deceptive, it's evil. You can't just educate. But even if somebody did change, the fact of the matter is justice demands, you know, justice demands that in the eyes of God that a life is that capital punishment. And then Jeff. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I see it's 11:30. I'll just kind of stick around a little bit if anybody wants to talk a little bit more about this, but you are dismissed. Thank you for coming today.